The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, it's springtime. Today is Easter, actually, in a different religion. And I was thinking about nature and the way the Buddha often used nature images to convey his teachings. And a common one is that of a stream of flowing water. And sometimes, what's interesting about this image is that sometimes he talks about going against the stream. In fact, that's the name of a Buddhist group, Against the Stream. And we can get this idea, even if we haven't practiced very long, is that, you know, our practice is asking that we don't so much follow conventional societal expectations or goals. We're doing something a little different than that. But then, maybe in contrast, we hear that the first stage of awakening is called stream entry, and it refers to a time when the person has, you know, really incorporated the Dharma into their heart and their life very deeply. So are we going against the stream? Are we entering the stream? It's a different stream in some sense. What's going on with these different streams? So we're going to talk about this and some things that emerge from it also. So starting with the more conventional stream, there's a lot that we're exposed to that sort of tells us how we should think and how we should live and what we should value and what we should aim for in life. We are not at all in a neutral background, and we're not kind of blank slates arriving at IMC or, you know, even, I don't know, even arriving in childhood. So we're told, you know, if you just drive down the freeway, you see ads for, I don't know, maybe an ad for a car, and it's got, you know, a beautiful woman draped across the hood. And so they're not just selling the car, they're selling this whole image, right, of what it's going to be like to have this object and to live in that way. That's pretty blatant. Probably we don't fall for those yet, or by our age or something. So, but even not so blatantly, you know, much more ingrained in the way that we live, there's a conventional model that we're offered. Get the job, have a partner, maybe have children, probably good to buy a house at some point, etc. We're given a kind of a template here. And that's not to say that we all follow it or value it, but it's not a neutral thing. It's out there. And many people come to understand at different levels of sophistication that this is not quite right for them. It's not really that satisfying, this model that we're offered. It's a little thin in spots, and if we actually do it, we can start to wonder, is this all? Is this really it? This is what I was supposed to do? And so, you know, we have a sense that this stream that we're supposed to just flow along with, or at least get in line with somehow, and it takes effort to do that, we start to wonder, is that really the stream I want to be in? And then even in our mind, you know, that's externally, but even in our mind, there's a stream, quote-unquote, that isn't that helpful for us. We may notice, especially if when we start meditating, that our thoughts can easily run along ruts that get it in trouble. You know, we start thinking about something and something that someone said, and pretty soon it's, why do they do that? And how can I get her to think in a different way? And we can spend a whole meditation session planning how we're going to approach this annoying person the next day. And then at some point we realize, gee, I don't know if I needed to think about that for 40 minutes. It didn't really seem to lead me toward much peace. You know, the streams of our mind that run toward anger or irritation or depression or sadness can really, or envy or greed, you know, can really harm the mind. That's not a stream we want to be following. Can bring it to non-peaceful states, bringing on its own suffering. So the Buddha knew about these unhelpful flows that we're exposed to externally and internally. I'm going to talk just a bit about a discourse where he touches on that. It has some technical terms in it, and we will skate along the surface of some of it to glean what's relevant here. But in this particular discourse, he starts talking about the way a conventional kind of person thinks and responds in the world. And you'll have to bear with me because I'm starting to study Pali. And so I want to share that this person is called the Asutava Putujano. Isn't that a great word? and Asutava, the first word, sut comes from to hear, actually. And so remember that in this society, there weren't like Dharma books, there wasn't audio Dharma. If you wanted to get teachings, you had to go hear them from somebody. And so it was quite special if you were in the position where you could hear teachings. And so Sutava actually means having heard or having been trained. They actually came to mean the same thing, or learned. And then Asutava is not, so not learned. And then Putujano is usually translated as worldling. So this is somebody who just is going along. They've just absorbed what society told them. And the Buddha talks about how a person like this experiences something called agitation through clinging. And then he's going to tell about how that happens. And so he says, this person who is not a seer of noble ones, unskilled in the noble one's Dhamma, untrained, regards form as self, we'll just substitute body, regards the body as self, or the body as possess, or the self as possessing the body, or the body as in the self, or the self as in the body. And this is philosophical. We won't go into these different views, but the point is that you get attached to the body, and it's so easy, right? And that's what we're encouraged to do, is to attach to the way we look, the way we are, what we have, these kinds of physical things. And then it says, then that form or body or physical thing changes and alters. If you ask anybody, do things change? They'll say yes. So it changes. And the word that's used for change is not just a change like I'm changing my hairstyle this week or something. It means kind of degeneration. So the understanding is it's changing in a way that it's, you know, it's going on the way out. And then, with that change and alteration in form, his mind, the words actually says, runs along with the change in form. So consciousness grabs on to the fact that things are changing. So to make it concrete, we look in the mirror, we see a little more gray hair, we see a new wrinkle, we notice a little more stiffness in that hand that we know is starting to develop arthritis. We know which way that's going. And the mind grabs onto that. Now, that's the fact. That's the reality. Then the mind grabs onto that, and it starts thinking about that, and as it gets worried about that, oh, no, oh, no, what's going to happen? How is that going to be? It's going to be horrible, this or that. In the next phrase in the sutta, agitation and a collection of mental states born of running along with the change in form, remain obsessing his mind. Does this sound familiar? Yeah, it's. And then it says, because her mind is obsessed, she is frightened, distressed, and anxious, and through clinging she becomes agitated. So this is. And then it goes on to talk about other things that we cling to. So not only the body or physical things, but also our mind, our perception, the way we think about things, you know, the more mental things that we can also cling to, just as surely our views, our opinions, our stories. This is actually a really sophisticated psychological analysis, compacted down into a few sentences with some, you know, words that we had to go over. But still, he's describing the stream, You know, something happens, we grab onto it and run down something that leads us to what? Fear, distress, and anxiety and agitation. And this is the stream that we are to go against. Okay, the stream. And if we're not paying attention, the mind can do this. We know the mind can do this because we've seen it. We've gotten caught in it. So it's interesting. And then consider also this phrase from the Dhammapada. This is Gill's translation. Death sweeps away the person obsessed with gathering flowers as a great flood sweeps away a sleeping village. So the gathering flowers is not like smell the flowers along the way. It's meant to imply chasing after pretty things and, you know, being so concerned with getting good stuff and making things pleasant that you're kind of not paying attention, like a sleeping village. And then there's this powerful image, right? As a great flood sweeps away a sleeping village. Now, in ancient India, floods sweeping away whole villages was a very real phenomenon. This happened every year. It happens every year in the monsoon season. For us in the West, it may not be as visceral of an image, but you have to understand this was very real to people there. And so again, we have this flowing water image rather clearly in a destructive sense, is that if we're not paying attention and we're just gathering our flowers, then we're going to be surprised by what? The alteration of form, like he talked about in the prior sutta that I read. Things change, something happens, something ends, something dies, and we're shocked. We can't believe it, and it's very stressful and distressing. So when we talk about it like this intellectually, it's clear that something we need to do something about this tendency of our mind to be swept along, to be swept away, that there are forces that are, you know, if we don't lead a more considered life, can, you know, allow the mind to flow into these non-peaceful states. But then there's this idea of stream entry. And, you know, whether you know that term or not is not important. There's this image of deeply immersing in the Dharma such that the mind is flowing with the wholesome, flowing with something that will eventually flow it to the ocean. And it's said directly in the suttas that the Eightfold Path is a stream. You know, it's also a path, but a different image would be that it's a stream and that one can get into this and can attune to this and align with the steps of the path such that spiritual practice is unfolding well. So this is more an image of easeful flow, of getting into something that can carry us along, in a sense. Here's another sutta. Just as the river Ganges slants, slopes, and inclines toward the east, so too, a person who develops and cultivates the Noble Eightfold Path slants, slopes, and inclines toward Nibbana. I love this image, actually, because it feels so natural, in a sense. You know, it's like there's a naturalness to getting in and flowing along. And this slanting, sloping, and inclining, you know, it's like that's where the mind's going to go anyway. And that to me feels very beautiful. And it's kind of a guide in whether I'm continuing on the path. You know, sure, there's effort sometimes. And there's also a sense that even when there's effort, there can be the ease of knowing that the path is unfolding, the stream is flowing along, we're slanting, sloping, and inclining toward less suffering. But now let's play a little bit with this two-stream idea. Maybe they're not as different as we thought. This is a poem from Rosemary Wattola Traumer. It was so lovely, the home I built in the arroyo. Such smooth golden plaster I worked with my hands, such luster in the wood. I had been told, of course, about the chance of flood. Perhaps some part of me felt relief when the current finally came. First a hum, then a roar, then the splintering din, and then only vehement rush. What does the soul want really but to join with the wild flood? Regret can only tread for so long. This now is what life wants. A fallen tree, a hand-carved beam, both serve as well for a float. Now, whatever the water says, that is where I go. So the home. It was so lovely, the home I built in the arroyo. What we thought of as stable and trustworthy. You know, we build our home growing up. We build something that we think is going to be stable, trustworthy. Of course, she knew about the chance of flood, alteration of form, perhaps. And then this sense that she describes so beautifully of the flood actually coming and wiping out this home, wiping out what she had originally thought was going to be stable, what she had built up somehow. And then it gets washed away, and she realizes that going with that flood is what life wants. So maybe the flood is not so bad. maybe there's a change in the mind that makes the difference between destructive flood and a flowing stream. We also hear in spiritual teachings this idea that the conventional flow, now returning to this idea of what we're supposed to live to, ideas of what's supposed to be stable, is that there's a lot of work associated with that. Sometimes spiritual teachings point toward how effortful it is to try to be somebody, to try to build something, to try to create this whole thing and then maintain it somehow. It's effortful and not that much fun sometimes. And in contrast, there's a sort of an ease and freedom depicted in flowing with the Dharma, which is more in line with the way things are, and not fighting that. We're still going to be living in the world. Here we are, we have a body. It has to eat and breathe and sleep, love. So we're going to have relationships and things that we do and all of that. But the question is kind of how we think about the stability and what we consider worth working for and how we perceive that whole process of living. So I'm going to, please pardon my mixed metaphor, the next poem I want to read switches to wind instead of water, but maybe you can get the same image. It's called Without a Doubt. Could be you feel like a tiny bird flapping hard, hard as you can, into the wind. Though there is no sign that says dead end, you are not going anywhere and can't imagine you ever will. Could be that all that fluttering exhausts you until you stop all that trying and turn away from whatever it is you think you are flying toward. And then perhaps you understand, not with your head, with your whole being, that wherever the wind is going to go, it will go. Could be you find yourself saying yes to the wind, the same wind, you know this, that fills your lungs. Could be that it is so beautiful, this new kind of flying, that you forget to be frightened that you do not know what will happen next. Could be you've never been so aware how infinite the sky. So, two streams or one stream. Maybe they're different dimensions of the same stream. We're talking here more in the realm of wisdom, but I want to shade now into talking about compassion also. The teachings I'm drawing from now are maybe more emphasized in other Buddhist traditions outside of our lineage, but I hope you'll feel some inspiration in it and see the analogy I'm drawing on. It's sometimes said that there are also two forms or dimensions of compassion, and they're sometimes called absolute and relative. And the first, absolute, is very profound, actually. It's about understanding deeply interconnection. So understanding that your suffering and my suffering are really not different, not so different. And, you know, as there's less and less self in the picture, there's just less and less difference in any kind of suffering. We're absolutely implicated in the big picture. No one is separate in this view. Yeah, and so from this perspective, from the perspective of absolute compassion and understanding the interconnection, no other way of being makes any sense except kindness and compassion. Sylvia Boorstein says, "Life is so difficult. How could you be anything but kind?" So this is something that we may not feel 24/7, but we can get glimpses of it, yeah. And then, you know, and then relative compassion is more about the nitty-gritty, the real relationships that we find ourselves in. Meaning, yeah, right now, these particular people in my life, this immediate situation in the grocery store, on the road, or at home. It's about finding compassion in these messy, real world situations. And it is not so easy. It's not so easy. Sometimes it's tempting to say, oh, I love all beings, you know, I do this profound meditation wishing everyone well. And then there's my boss. Or whatever, you know, we pull out of IMC, get on the road, and snap at the person who's driving too slow in front of us. You know, it's like, wait a minute. I love all beings except the ones right in front of me. So relative compassion is definitely work, and it's a practice, you know. So this kind of compassion operates within this conventional stream of life. It includes not only interpersonal interactions, but social actions, working for better laws, protecting the environment, developing and delivering social services, serving as a healer, a counselor, a teacher, etc. But in this work, we have to live with knowing that it may or may not succeed. Okay, there's no guarantee that our attempt to help actually helps. And the work is endless. If you really look at the world, we'll never end suffering in the conventional world completely. There's too much, and the causes of it persist and recur. Sure, there's temporary changes, but in the big overall picture, we have to admit that. And so then, you know, it becomes interesting, right? Why are we doing this? We have to tap into the heart somehow. There's a story about a big storm at sea that washes up onto the shore just thousands and thousands of clams. And, you know, they're gonna dry out on the beach when this goes back. And there's a person standing there, kind of walking along the beach maybe, and they're one by one throwing the clams back into the water. And someone comes along and looks at the thousands and thousands of clams and this one person throwing clam by clam and says, there are so many, it hardly matters what you're doing. And the person throwing clams says, it matters to this one. Yeah? So we do the work of relative compassion best when it's supported by this larger absolute impersonal compassion, if you will, by knowing that there's really no other route to happiness and peace than to work on ending suffering that's right in front of us in whatever way possible. You know, so once again, we have these two different ideas that are not so different. There's one stream, which is challenging and painful when it's all that is known. All we know is the conventional world. All we know is the fact that we can't save the world completely. Very painful. But it can be nourished and supported by becoming aware of another dimension, a second stream that flows somehow in parallel or within or surrounding the first, sort of a more subtle stream that nonetheless provides something essential for the shared world that we all live in, which is this world. This real world. So what stream are you in? And what is it nourished by? And what needs to be tapped into to fully feel your life, to fully live your life? Could be you've never been quite so aware how infinite the sky. So thank you. Those were my thoughts for this morning, and I'd welcome any questions or comments. We have time. I'd love to hear from you.
Kim, I'd just like to say, I've heard the clam story before, but never so beautifully as the way you wove it into the talk today.
I'm really touched by the life is so difficult quote.
Sylvia Boorstein.
I'm going to Google it, but I'm just touched by it at work. It just seems obvious with family and people close to you and kindness, but I'm thinking one away, two away, and how relevant it is.
I don't recall the name of it, but the first poem you read about the arroyo, before the flood, in that poem there's a couple of lines that precedes the flood coming, and first it's a hum, and then it's a something, and then it's a something else. And I think it's important to know that we all hear and see the hum before the flood comes. I mean, the flood is in this room with us right now. And there's a lot of denial about what we are hearing and seeing and feeling.
Beautifully said. And mindfulness is a way of pointing ourselves toward it, slowly but surely. And we need help from other people who are doing the same thing. Because you're right, there is, I'll use this to say one thing that's coming to mind. The word ignorance We tend to maybe react a little bit to that. It sounds a little insulting. But ignorance in the way the Buddha talked about it means ignoring, turning away from. And there's kind of a sense of, like, we know it's there, but we're not quite looking at it. And that's the part of the mind that wants to, you know, put on the blinders. And it takes some effort and some real heart to say, no, I want to open those blinders. I want to see. That's what we're working against, is these tendencies in our mind to want to ignore. And it's a process, a lifelong process.
That I really, really, really identify with. I really, really, really identify with that bird.
Feel like the one that's flying into the wind.
Yeah, yeah,
so yeah.
That really, that analogy is going to stick with me.
Thank you.
I was thinking a few moments ago about how hard it is for me to see my prejudice. You know, because intellectually I have this idea of equality, that, you know, and I know as a fact that, you know, we are equal in the grander sense. But sometimes my early training plus whatever, you know, leads me into feeling and thinking that, even if it's only for a moment, that I am superior to X or that person. And it's really hard to see because it goes against my basic belief. So it's one of those things that when I see it, it's a real gift because it's very hard to see.
That was beautifully said, is that we have these values or beliefs or perceptions that are in place, and mostly they've served us. That's kind of why we put them in place. But by that very nature, then it's hard to see things that don't conform to that. Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I needed your talk this morning, having just returned from doing one of these retreats where we take 7 lost people away at a time, and that feels like, you know, throwing one clam back in the ocean, one at a time. And it also occurred to me watching some of the people we were working with, how attached it's possible to get to one's own suffering. And then how that blinds you to the fact that anybody else in the room is also suffering.
Yes.
I feel a desire to put online that this week we went to Project Homeless Connect, which is in San Francisco, and there was a young man who had just gotten out of jail a month ago after being in for 22 years. And he looked to me to be about 35. He was a teenager when he went in. He's been out for 1 month, and what he described he has done in this 1 month was pretty amazing, very amazing. But it was with help of others, other souls who had kind of been along the way just for this single month. And he said, what I find is every day I do one thing that matters toward my moving forward. Yay for all of that.
I was thinking when you were talking about the the woman who built her house in an arroyo, I thought, well, how lame is that? And a comment that Cheryl made on, I mean, you know, but a comment that Cheryl made this morning on the way driving here, I forget the context exactly, but it was one of my favorite quotes from A Course in Miracles, which is, my attack thoughts are attacking my invulnerability. And their notion is that in the grand scheme of things, we're ultimately as souls, as energy forms, invulnerable. Our physical body, of course, is vulnerable. But when we identify, speaking to your talk this morning, Kim, when we strongly identify with us being a physical body, we're very vulnerable. But in terms of being judgmental of this person building her house there, I thought, yeah, and Jeff, here you are, living in an earthquake zone. How much denial is that? And also remembering one of my things in my to-do list for the past probably couple years is to replenish my emergency water supply. And have I done that? No. So maybe I should take the lesson that Cheryl heard from her intake person at Homeless Connect this week and start looking at some of the prioritizing stuff. Instead of looking at more nonsense on the internet, maybe I ought to replenish my water and other things that would help to prepare at least for that eventuality. Recalling what USGS told us in, when was it, 89, that there was a, what was the number, 75, 80, 90% chance of the major earthquake happening in the next 25 years. And I'm not great at math, but I think we're there.
Well, when the flood comes, there will be plenty of water.
No doubt. Well, especially in San Mateo, when I worked for the county mental health, they talked to us about the dam at the top of the hill having a very high percentage chance of breaking in the water from the reservoir emptying into San Mateo. So, yeah, there'll be plenty of water.
All right. Thank you.